kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 77 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast with me, Di Barnes, and...
me, Doug Belshaw. Di, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
I didn't realise it was your birthday until it popped up on my Google calendar, and it was towards the end of the day, so...
That's all right, don't worry. Social media has changed birthdays. And I don't think I got very many in comparison to others, but it was like 40-odd people on Facebook, a few people on Twitter, some on Instagram, some on Facebook Messenger. It's interesting how different people said happy birthday. And some people face-to-face, but obviously not many can do that. But it's a really nice thing, a sort of aspect of social media, just to say happy birthday to people. It reminds you, it's just nice to hear from them.
Because, see, it's nice when, you've turned, 27? It's nice at whatever age to, 46, right. It's nice at whatever age to have your birthday remembered. It's not just for kids, is it? It's your special day. I remember reading kind of Russian 19th century literature when I was younger, and they're all about name days. And I used to think that name days must be so disappointing compared to birthdays. You know, just celebrating the saint that you were named after rather than actually, hey, it's the day I was born. Everyone look at me.
Yes, well, this is it, isn't it? So I was born on St. David's Day, and hence christened David, and which is the patron saint of Wales, for those who do not know. And because Welsh for David is Di, I was called Di Bach from a little boy.
I see.
And that's why I'm called Di.
My daughter came back from Beavers, which has just started, with a black flag with a yellow cross on it. Is that actually the right flag? Because it didn't seem to me like it was.
No, I don't know that flag. I'm not Welsh. The only thing Welsh about me is my name, I'm afraid.
Oh, come on, Di, do you homework? Cool. So you had a good day?
I had a lovely day, yeah. So I was just teaching and doing all the work, and then I went out to play football, and we won with the staff team against the local league, and we won. That was really good. I went for a couple of beers in the pub with the footballers afterwards and a couple of friends, and that was that. Birthday done. Very nice. Wonderful.
Done for another year. Excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. But I always like my birthday because it comes along, you know, spring's just around the corner, the days are getting longer, the weather's getting brighter, the flowers are out and all of that, it's lovely.
Similar thing for me, my birthday, December the 22nd, is kind of the first day after the longest night, or the shortest day, you know what I mean? So it only gets better after my birthday.
That's it. It's sort of a good marker, isn't it? Yeah. And that's what I think.
Cool. Well, I have been in Rome this week, and it was nice and warm. It was 19 degrees, which I always think, it doesn't sound that warm. But of course, when you're coming from Northumberland, which, you know, tonight it's been 4 or 5 degrees watching my son play football, but it feels like about 1 or 0 because of the bitingly cold wind. It was beautifully warm in Rome, and I had a great time. And yeah, it was good.
Cool. That's very good. What were you doing in Rome?
St. George's British International School had me over for their inset, and I did kind of their keynote on really just empowering them. You know, I've been on the receiving end of these things where some consultants come in and done the same keynote that they do everywhere and doesn't pay any attention to the context. So I thought, well, that's not my style. So I tried to go in, find a bit about them, tailored what I was doing to their context, and just tried to say, look, this isn't about applying something that someone else has come up with. This is about you deciding in your professional practice what you want to do. And they seemed to respond pretty well to that. The thing that I found hilarious, which Paul, who knew me from, I think I mentioned this last week, from school history forum days, mm-hmm. He said that there's two forms of silence in the school. There's Italian silence, where you just keep on talking but a bit quieter, and the staff do this as well. And then there's British silence, which is everyone's completely quiet, which I thought was hilarious as well.
It's true. I had a bit of that today.
So yeah. a lovely school. The great-grandson of Mussolini, mm-hmm. that was there, which must make teaching elements of World War II interesting.
Was there? Oh, yes, of course, that would be about right, yeah. Well, okay, mm-hmm. So there was a pupil.
Yeah, so... so Mussolini's great-grandson, and then Sergio Leone's grandchildren, and also the wealthiest family in Italy, from what I can gather as well. So, you know, quite a magnet for that kind of family. But I didn't see any students because it was inset day, but I did see the staff who were uniformly lovely, really interested in kind of developing digital literacies and also potentially using open badges, which was great. And yeah, had a really good time, hung out with them in a wine bar. And then, which was one of the highlights for me, I've only ever been to Rome with other people, including mainly my wife. And so in the evening, just went into the city centre by myself, and all of the things like the Pantheon and the Trevi Fountain and the Forum and stuff were all lit up, and just wandered around there for an hour and a half, and it was magical. It really was.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Sounds lovely. So it's always nice to get away and see a city in a different way. That's what I thought about San Francisco. It's just walking around the city is kind of, you know, you don't want to go and see anything in particular, I didn't think, but going, I mean, except for like the Golden Gate Bridge, I wanted to see and go on the bay and stuff. But just walking around, that's what I liked.
It's that element of being a flaneur. And I know Amy Bevel, who we mentioned off on this podcast, and we're going to be talking about one of her posts later on, which I used in the keynote. She often talks about how wonderful it is to be a flaneur. And when I see some of her photographs, I really like the fact that she obviously pays attention to all the little things in life. I remember being in somewhere in France, I think, when we were traveling around last year, and just noticing all of the drain pipes, which were extremely ornate, and just little things like that that you notice when you take time rather than hurrying between places. So yeah, I love all those liminal spaces you've got where you haven't got anything programmed and you can just wander and do whatever you want. I like that. And I also started reading Mary Beard's SPQR, which are the, it's Italian for basically the Roman state and Roman people. And it's a wonderful, wonderful history.
All right, brilliant. I saw you were tweeting things saying history teacher quite a lot. What was that all about?
Yeah, so hashtag history teacher is a hashtag I used back when I was teaching history, but it's still used, obviously, people like Russell Tarr and Paul, who was at St. George's, and other people still use it. And what happens, I might tweet something because, you know, I'm still a history teacher. As I said, I'm still a history teacher. I've just lost my class. but, you know, I still want to tweet about historical things and philosophical things. So sometimes when I see something that someone else has tweeted, I will quote it and just put hashtag history teacher to draw attention to, you know, my colleagues as I still see them. So, yeah, I just thought it was a useful thing to put out there and just to show the fact that, you know, I still, if you don't have to scrape very far beneath the surface to find the teacher, and especially the history teacher in me.
Yeah, fair play. Well, yeah, today I did something interesting, technically speaking. Mm-hmm. I distributed to a few people their new devices in the sort of project that I'm doing, which is looking at looking at inking in teacher technology. And so that was quite fun. So I distributed, three Surface Books, Microsoft Surface Books, a couple of Surface Pros, an Asus, whatever it's called, Surface Pro equivalent. The Dell Latitude version hasn't shown up yet. An iPad Pro.
Oh, is this what you were talking about last week, where you want to get them to use the same Surface but on different devices, same service but on different devices?
Yes, that's right. So the same teaching learning management system, as I call them, and they should be called. But they will rotate devices. So, and then we're just looking at what benefits it can. So the approach we've taken with it is that the devices were boxed when they got them. So they're unboxing the devices and they have to go through the setup process and work.
Have you made them do an unboxing video on YouTube?
I didn't make them do that.
Oh, missed opportunity.
It was tight. Where I had to get lunch served in a different place, and you know, no one's got any time in school. So,
well, I mean, I'm just saying that tongue in cheek. For those listening who don't know what I'm talking about with an unboxing video, just type in unboxing video into YouTube.
It's some people's favorite thing to do. It's like getting the shiny and sharing it.
Yeah, I can remember the days when technology just came in a boring brown box. In fact, I can remember going to PC World, and they used to have the brown box little section over there. And trying to get bargains on like CPU coolers and stuff. Yep. Whereas now everything comes in the shiniest box ever. Like my new laptop came in almost like Apple style shiny box.
So the one that was remarkable. So the Surface Book boxes were quite ornate and amazing. But the one that was most striking was the Asus one, and that was sort of this sort of dark blue indigo cardboard box, very beautiful. and with gold writing on the front, but not quite gold. It wasn't. It was just very elegantly done.
Oh, okay.
It looked like something, you know, my father might buy my mother for their 50th wedding anniversary.
Yeah.
You know, and it looked really special and beautiful. But when you got it out, it's just a bit of computer, which is great. There's nothing wrong with them. So it would be interesting to see how they get on with that. So they're all doing some evaluation and writing a little diary of what goes on with them and their devices. And using them with the children, obviously.
So you say they're writing a diary. Is that literally pen and paper, or are they blogging it, or what?
No, it will be. So I haven't worked out quite how we're going to do it yet, because I kind of want to record what they say in different ways, but I might just do a separate Google. So I have a Google Doc that manages everything.
Could they not use, Google Keep, because that allows you to do voice notes, transcription?
I think so, but I want the information to be accessible to other people afterwards. So I thought about just a Google group, maybe.
Or
indeed just having a Google Doc, so they don't feel like what they're putting out is on show, but then it can be shared afterwards or tidied up and shared. But I just want them to put good things and bad things that they find about it, or I haven't got time to do this, or whatever, you know, whatever that comes, and we'll see what happens.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it should be fun. Should be good.
I did see today when I logged into Google Docs. So the reason that's kind of jogged my memory is I was doing some work in Google Docs today, and something popped up saying, you can now import your notes from Google Keep. So I think one of the workflows they're trying to encourage is people just making notes out and about, and then kind of putting that into a bigger Google Doc later on. So
that makes sense. I use Google Keep quite a lot, and I had this interesting thing. If you talk about Microsoft OneNote, and then you talk to a comparison to Google Keep as a comparative note-taking application, they're not really. And a note is not a note. One note is not another. There are many definitions or permutations of what a note can be to different people in different ways.
It's different metaphors, isn't it, really? They're stretching metaphors in different directions.
This is it, and the word is getting stretched beyond its purpose, I think, or beyond its... It makes it unuseful to have that word to describe both things.
It's an interesting conversation, isn't it, as to at what point do you jettison the crutch or the skeuomorphic analogy? So if you look now, we're in Google Docs, you know, with the show notes. Google doesn't use a floppy disk icon to represent save anymore, but some applications still do. And you think, well, there's a whole generation of students, at least, if not people in their 20s, who have literally never seen a floppy disk.
So what am I using at the moment? We're doing HTML and CSS, and they're using Notepad++ for it. Mm. And Notepad++, even though it's obvious to somebody who's been using it for a little while, when you first hit it and you don't really know what it's for, it's quite a foreign piece of software, the way it color codes the text and things like that.
Mm.
And when you type a speech mark, it types two, because it's giving you them both to put in between and things like
oh,
that.
Oh, of course, yeah, that, like an atom has, as well. Yeah.
Yeah, that has a save icon, two save icons, one for save all, because you have multiple files open at once, and one for just saving. And I say click the disk icon, and they just have no idea what that is. Absolutely none.
I tell you what I try to do. You know, I often talk about a website called The Setup, or it's at usersthis.com. I noticed that almost everybody who used Linux used Emacs or Vim, and there was a big kind of flame war about this. And the deal was that Emacs, which has been around since the late 70s, early 80s, is your one-stop environment for writing, and you kind of have to learn it. But once you've learned it, you'll spend all of your life in there. You can browse the web in it. You can do all these kinds of things in it. I tried to learn it, and it was so arcane. It was... I couldn't do it.
Well, there you go. And it's interesting, isn't it? Right. Let's rack on, shall we?
There's a couple of things I just want to point to this week that I've written. Uh-huh. One, I've been trying to find a home for a while. Brian Mathers and I were commissioned by Concentric Sky, who are a technology company, and they make Badger, which is an open source badge issuing platform.
Right, yes, I know Badger.
It was funny, actually, at St. George's. Someone literally thought I was talking about badgers, as in nocturnal animals, as opposed to... because of my dodgy northern accent.
How come that's not been done? Surely, you know, so you do the badge newsletter and things like that. That deserves a badger right on there, doesn't
it? Badger, exactly.
Confusing stuff, maybe.
So, you know, this is our podcast, so I can bitch on about this, but opensource.com, right? I've published there before, and it's great, and I visited myself, and there's wonderful writing on there. And it's supported by Red Hat, who make billions of dollars supporting open source, and that's great. But twice that I've published articles in there, it's been such a hassle. So the first time I had to argue, you know, the point of what I was writing and why it should stay the way it is and everything. And this one, they changed the title of my post at the last minute. One of Brian's images is pixelated, and they moved some of the images about, so it makes no sense in any order. So the article is titled, it should have been titled, you know, Making Credentials More Transparent Through Open Source, Open Badges, and Open Pathways. But they've used the 2012 title, Is This the End of the Traditional Resume? Which is not really what it's about. But anyway.
So why do you think they've made these changes? Have you editors hat on to see what they think? You think they're trying to do?
Well, the optimist in me would be because they know their audience, and because not everybody has spent the last 5 or 6 years down the rabbit hole of alternative credentials. But at the same time, like, you know, don't accept the article if you don't think it's a good fit. So anyway, it's published. It's been shared quite a lot, which is nice. And it talks about open pathways and how we need to talk about badge pathways rather than just badges themselves. And that linked to a presentation. Oh, I haven't put that in. I might do that later. I presented really late last night to an Australian ACODE, which is the Australian Council for Online and Distance Education. Okay. And yeah, that was a weird experience. I mean, I've presented lots online, including that tribal blockchain thing I was mentioning last week. But this was the first occasion, Di, where I've presented, there's been a webcam facing the room, and I can see myself on the screen, obviously delayed by a couple of seconds, at the back of the room.
Okay, how distracting.
Which was quite strange. But it went fine, and, you know, just, I was talking to my mother came to watch Ben play football just now. And you talk about these things like, oh, yeah, and I presented to literally the other side of the world where it was the next day there and they were asking me questions in real time on Twitter. And you're just, like, taking all this in your stride. And my mother's just standing there with eyes wide open going, oh, my goodness. And it's easy to forget, you know, how crazy that is in 2017. But, yeah, it went well. It went well.
Good.
And then just the other thing I wanted to mention is a post which... often when I go and work with organizations, using the experience that I had at Mozilla, I talk about the importance of having everyone knowing what the mission of the organization is, even if it's make shitloads of money, yeah? And then tied to that, the manifesto of how you go about achieving that mission. And Mozilla is exemplary in that regard. You know, the mission is to keep the web, the internet kind of free and open and available for everyone. And there's 10 manifesto points. And if you go to the Mozilla Manifesto, which I linked to in this article, then it links to the, for each point, almost every point links to the web literacy map, which, you know, the work that I started at Mozilla. So I thought, well, I need to do my own for, like, dynamic skill set, which is not, I don't really talk about my limited company very much, because for most people, it's just the limited company that happens to invoice them after I do the work, and they're interested in me doing the work. Or the co-op doing the work. But I thought, well, I do need to walk the talk. And someone called Emma Cragg wrote an issue of her newsletter where she was talking about the importance of manifestos. And I thought, well, this is serendipity, and I need to write this right now. So on my way back from Rome on Tuesday, I wrote 10 points that I think kind of should underpin the mission of my organization. And, you know, the mission, I changed my strap line on my website at the start of the year to helping people and organizations become more productive in their use of technology, which I'm pretty happy with. And so I just came up with 10 things related to that. It's not perfect, but it's something to iterate upon. So.
Well, let's run through them, okay? So
yeah,
we'll just go a bit of game of tennis on this. So number one is to share openly.
Yep. Number two, teach digital skills and literacies.
Number three, embrace change.
Four, trust but check or verify.
Number five, encourage diversity in credentialing.
Six, evangelize for stronger privacy and security.
Number seven, go open source wherever possible.
Number 8, respect difference.
Number 9, discover what motivates people.
And number 10, focus on learning. And I go into detail about, well, a little bit of detail, a couple of sentences on each one. So what do you think?
I like completely. So lots of them, some of them stick out. Some of them I would have, I think.
Mm.
And I like trust but check. I was just thinking about that today. There was an article, I read it on Facebook, actually, that Ian O'Byrne posted. Hello, Ian, if you're listening. And it was about a professor who's been asked to resign because he's insisted that he wants to, for a psychology professor, I think it was.
Oh, I saw this. Yeah, he asked for the data.
He wanted the data behind every article or paper or journal article or whatever that he was asked to comment upon or whatever. He wanted the data that was built that claim was based upon, and which seems a very, very fair request.
And he was sacked because of that, yeah.
I saw the word resign rather than sack.
But, oh, okay. But even so, if you feel like you're being forced out because you're doing your job, basically.
Well, yeah, and if you're invited to resign, you know, for people. Mm-hmm.
I think this links to what we were talking about last week in terms of we talked about things like a. Evidence and a kind of a crisis of reproducibility in science. And I know that the Mozilla Science Lab is actively working with GitHub and people to try and using badges for this as well, trying to get people to share their data. Because otherwise, if you don't share your data, and if it's copyrighted or proprietary, then you can't reproduce the experiment or the conditions under which you're making the claim. So it's kind of it's the antithesis of scientific inquiry.
Yes, I think it's interesting. So I thought, well, why at this university, you know, people, so I always like to think about, even in extremist Trump, why are people doing the things that they're doing? Why are they making these decisions, especially people in power? And then it seems as though it's a really wrong decision. So what are they doing? So that's like I asked you about that article on open source. You know, what do you think that they're doing? They're not trying to piss you off. So what are they trying to get to? And with that, so why have this university helped this guy to the edge of his profession over this? And I was trying to think, well, maybe it's undermining in their profession that if something has achieved a publication status, that it to say that you need to see the data behind the work is to undermine the professional integrity of those that have written the article and indeed publications that have chosen to publish it.
So
I thought there might be something in that, and that you're actually challenging the very mechanisms by which these institutions operate, and they are one of those institutions by which whom he's employed.
There's that, and there's also the fact that in the world of peer review there's a lot of arseholes.
That's true.
And, you know, I say this as somebody who's tried to get things published in peer-reviewed journals, and also as somebody who, in a very small way, has peer-reviewed stuff. You know, when I was at JISC, peer-reviewed a couple of articles. And I've read plenty of stuff on, you know, people reading the same thing 6 months later and giving it a different score, or people just wanting their own work to be cited, or people, you know, holding grudges, or just basically people being human and doing what humans do. But this could have been, you don't know the wider situation, and people might have assumed that this was someone just using their power in an inappropriate way. So who knows what's going on, really?
Yeah, so it strikes me, I remember studying R.D. Lang at university, and looking at psychology in a very sort of brief way for a little while. And one of the things that they did is they took people who had been diagnosed schizophrenic, certified schizophrenic and that kind of thing. And then they took people who had never been certified with any kind of psychological problem, and put them through the panels which adjudicate, you know, judge you to be mad or not, as it were. That's probably a wrong word to use. But And the, you know, people who were clinically sane got sectioned, and people who were clinically insane were told they were fine.
Oh, exactly. Because how do you prove that you're not mad?
Yeah.
Because it's that halo effect. It's like we talked on this podcast before about people who have been told that, well, these kids here, like, they don't know it yet. But that shows that they've got real promise and they might grow up to be geniuses. And of course, teachers treat them differently than other kids who, you know, it's a similar kind of situation. It's the same as we were talking about last week in terms of there's no evidence that doesn't come with theories by which you're trying to interrogate the evidence. So,
yeah,
We should crack on. I have put a title in here today, which is EdTech Learning in Real Life, which is really me just saying, here's a bunch of links which look like they might go together. What do you reckon?
I reckon it works. Let's do it. There's some interesting stuff in here. So we're starting off with an article from Edutopia called Are We Innovating or Just Digitizing Traditional Teaching? So this is something that you and I, and I'm sure others listening, have been thinking about for ages through the Salmon model and such, like the idea of substitution or redefinition and anything in between. And then if you look at sort of project-based learning, and Elan Ezekiel and I have been talking about that this week. And hello, Elan, if you're listening. And yes, and the idea that some of this stuff is actually quite hard to do, and you have to, and few practitioners do it well. So is this about this? Is this about the stuff that's just not being doing well? Is digitizing traditional teaching, or is there actually some innovation going on out there?
Yeah, this Edutopia article talks about the peril and the promise. And I quite like the article where the paragraph where he's talking about the peril. So it says, the dissemination of digitized teacher-driven content is not full blended learning. Though this can be viewed as a first step towards new models of learning, the peril lies in complacency. When blended learning is equated with digital workflow, students remain consumers of teacher-directed content instead of becoming creators of knowledge within a context that they can actively control. End of quote. So my thesis supervisor, Steve Higgins, Professor Steve Higgins at Durham University, he did that, back in the day, that iPad, the interactive whiteboard study, which basically said they're bollocks. And his thing was always that interactive whiteboards increase the size of the teacher bubble and reduce the size of the student bubble in terms of agency and in terms of control. Uh-huh. And, of course, you can lock down mobile devices as much as you want. And if it's just a content delivery system, doesn't really matter how you're delivering it, does it, at the end of the day?
No, that's absolutely right. It's just the same thing is going on. And I think that there's no harm in that, as anyone says, but the point is that when people have achieved that, that's one of the issues with the project I'm doing at the moment, actually, is that I'm deliberately going for substitution in the first instance. So the teaching and learning management system, generally speaking, only substitute what you do with paper at the moment. And that's the natural way that people feel inclined to do things. It's like, oh, I do this, I could do this with technology, and it will.
And that's right. And like it's saying in this article, there's nothing wrong with starting there. It's just the problem is people get stuck there. And it's interesting. I had a conversation today with a guy called Guy Shearer, who you might know.
I don't.
So Guy has been experimenting with badges for a while. He is head of assessment and IT, I think, for the David Ross Educational Trust, which is a multi-academy trust in England. 33 schools, I think they've got. And he's invited me along to their first ever kind of technology champions conference, which they're going to hold in June. And the reason he wanted me to come along, and I think he's going to give me a pretty free hand, is because he wants to make the event not just about celebrating what they've done and being like, rah, rah, look at us, but challenging people to go to the next level. And I think that fits into what's going on here, because it's easy to go, yay, we started using iPads and people are actually using them, as opposed to, well, that was the first step and look at this massive journey that we've still got to go on, but it's possible and here's the next step. So yeah, I thought it was interesting. I like what Will Richardson said at the bottom. Do you see that?
I didn't know. What is he saying?
It says, in a recent blog post, Will Richardson raised the point that educators not give agency to students through choice or technology or even blended learning. Instead, students acquire it, i.e. agency, when teachers create the conditions under which agency can flourish.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. So I'm going to use a little football analogy here. So last season, Leicester Football Club won the Premier League outstandingly under Claudio Ranieri, Italian manager.
And then this season, under the same manager, having lost only a couple of players, I think, they have done awfully, and he's just been sacked. And there's this interesting thing about creating the conditions under which agency can flourish, because it's so Ranieri created a culture when he arrived at the club that facilitated the club to be the most successful football club. You know, the story of that last year's league is enormous. And you wonder if he created the conditions under which he could do that. He was the golden manager throughout that time. Then all of a sudden this season, it's not gone quite so well. And then as soon as he leaves, the next match that they have, they go and beat Liverpool, who are a much better team than them on paper this year. And
I think there's two different effects at work there. You know, we talked before about, so the first, I definitely agree with creating a culture there. We talked about football last week. We talked about Jose Mourinho.
Yeah.
But I think it often happens, doesn't it, that when a manager leaves, the next match, the players do much better and the team does much better. And I think that's kind of the Hawthorne effect kicking in there. Like when you make any type of change, as long as it's noticeable, then people usually up their game because they feel like the eyes are on them. In that particular case, it was because the senior Leicester players were accused of somehow being involved in his departure. But yeah, I think there's two different effects in it's a lot easier to make a short term change, like chopping and changing a manager or firing a teacher or getting rid of a principal, than it is creating culture, because that takes time and it's quite a delicate thing as well.
Mm. Yeah, and it's an easy thing to get wrong as well, I guess.
I'm doing some work with the Math Leadership Network in Ontario, and I met them yesterday to talk about what the work I'm going to be doing over there. And they've got an interesting situation where 10 years ago, the Ontario brought in a constructivist maths curriculum. And since then, math scores have consistently gone down. So the obvious kind of takeaway from that would be, oh, constructivist learning doesn't work in terms of raising math scores. But their argument is that teachers aren't using constructivist pedagogies. They are, you know, using what all traditional teachings that they've done before, and so therefore students aren't prepared for the kind of test that they are given. So one of the things they want me to do is to create kind of communities of practice with them and work more openly and think about how they can actually reward and encourage teachers to do the thing which they think works best, which is an interesting, you don't often get that, you know, people being very committed to progressive pedagogies and resisting the call to go back to very traditional teacher at the front, drill and kill kind of thing.
Yes. It's interesting stuff. Just remind me of this, I wonder what you think about this, sort of balance of this, of this idea. So Amy Burville, hello Amy if you're listening, shared with me some videos from Learning and Development last year. I'm not sure whether we talked about them on time because I think it might have been in our fallow period. This guy basically did this sort of break. So he's looking at learning in organizations rather than schools, in companies, and training particularly, and a sort of HR thing. But he talked really insightfully, I thought, about, he worked with, who was it, I think, IBM. And he talked about, he sort of, it's a long time, it's like 6 months ago or more since I watched it. But he basically boiled everything down to say something that made great sense to me, which was, really what you're trying to do is provide resources for learning that are useful, and you use the tube map as an analogy for that. You know, it's not something you learn, it's a resource that you use to help you do what you need to do. And but then he also said that it's getting the learners to care is the big deal.
Right.
So I often wonder about this in the sort of little bit of academic research or action research that I've done for my MA and in my work in general. And reading stuff that I do about education, that people talk about the different types of learning and whatever, is that really what you're trying to do is to get the learner to care about their work. And it doesn't really matter how you do that. It matters that you achieve that. That's right. The thing you're really looking for. You could do that in any way, and that's when you look at this sort of, you know, the Hawthorne effect and that whatever. And I wondered, so looking at Will Richardson's quote there, of creating the conditions under which agency can flourish, it's just another way. I was wondering, well, what are those conditions, Will? What are you saying? And partly, I would argue that those conditions is that you're making, or making seems to be the wrong word, but you're creating a climate in which people can care, do care, not can care, but do care about their work. And that's, so Claudio Ranieri possibly was making the players care about their work, making them feel valued, making them feel they're important, their contribution had to be really on point, you know, and that kind of thing. I don't know.
No, I think that's right. And I always find it strange when my kids like things which are pretty prescribed. I think, well, surely wouldn't you want to be more creative? But actually they like knowing where the boundaries are. This reminds me of something which I saw in the newspaper yesterday, I think, actually. So this was in the I newspaper, which is, you know, from the Independent. And it was in the education section. It was about literacy. And it was talking about, the title is How Soft Toy Sleepovers Could Help a Child to Read.
I read this in your newsletter, yes.
Can you see this? Right. It was just on Twitter, actually, because it was just yesterday.
Oh, it was on Twitter, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
So you said something,
it was something like it, wasn't it? Yeah.
That seemed like a lot of work, is what you said.
So this thing here, and let me just stick the link, and I'll tidy it up later, Di, but let's just stick the link in there so you've got it there. But what this was, so they're trying to encourage young people to read, and that is a fantastic thing to do, you know? But it says, researchers have discovered a novel way to encourage children to read more by sending soft toy animals for a library sleepover. So basically, their parents are involved, they're involved, the library staff are involved. They go to the library, they take the stuffed toy and they put it somewhere, and then the next morning, the library staff have moved the toy to choose a book, which then the child reads because the toy has selected it. I'm like, for goodness sake, how much resource is that taking up? Just get parents to read in front of their kids. Like, you could even force the situation and it to happen outside the home. But literally, that's what you need. Literally.
I was thinking about this. So I read this really disturbing article, actually, which I probably should have put in here. Was it a Guardian article over the weekend? And I don't know if it's from your newsletter or not, but it's somebody talking about children of a young age, like 5 years old, walking around with their hands sort of not clasped together, but held close in front of their chest, like they were holding a mobile device, because that's how they see their parents walking around so much. And then in the same article, it said that a child should not be allowed to touch a touch screen until they're 12 years old. And which is crazy, but when, you know, we've talked about this before, they're jewels, you know, touch screens are jewels, and to a child that doesn't have much control over the world, then you can imagine this is a big, big deal. And I do think, I mean, you spend quite a lot of energy and time staggering your children's use of technology and managing that and making sure it's okay and having discussions and disputes as they get older as those.
Yeah, so just to update people who listen to this podcast often, I've taken every game off my son's phone this week.
And because he...
Because he doesn't know... He can't help himself, really. And, you know, he... When I gave him an option of, you can keep the games on your phone, but if I find you using them at an inappropriate time again, then I'm going to take your phone off you. That's one option. Or the other option is, I can take the games off your phone. What do you want me to do? And he said, take the games off my phone.
It's interesting, isn't it? The article was quite controversial in that way, but it was an interesting thing. Steve Jobs kept touchscreens off his children for a long, long time. Mm. But I watched the Steve Jobs film, and it seemed as though his children were in a bit of a mess. So I don't know where that was.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. I should imagine he wasn't around very much.
Oh well, indeed. But So it's certainly not something to hold up, is what I mean by that. It's
no, indeed. And I think it's easy to say, oh, let's ban this thing.
Yeah.
Because then you don't have to think about it.
Yeah. But how difficult would it be to actually keep touchscreens off a child, off my child, off your child, until they're 12 years old?
Well, of course, because we've talked about this in terms of children roaming, you know, and doing that less than we did when we were younger, and certainly our grandparents and whatever. And you don't exist, your family unit doesn't exist in isolation. So you have to kind of take on the norms of society. So, hey, what happened, and probably the same for you, Di, what happened when you were younger? You went to the house of the most permissive parent.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly my children did that. They used to go and I knew when they were going out late and staying out later than we would let them stay out, because they would stay at a parent's house who didn't see them to bed, whereas we saw our children to bed every night until they were of us. I think actually always. So they would go and stay at certain people's houses, and we would insist that we spoke to the parents to say that you are seeing my child into the house kind of thing. You are care of
my. So unless you're going to never let your kids go around other people's houses, which is ridiculous, or, you know, it's you don't have full control anyway, so you might as well teach them stuff.
I wonder what Brian thinks about that, because he doesn't have TV at home, does he?
He doesn't, although, you know, I've been around his house, you know, a few times now. And the kids do, you know, watch films on his large laptop and stuff. And they do mess about in the shed with the Raspberry Pi and things. And they have got iPads and stuff. So he hasn't got a TV, but I don't think they're short of media particularly.
No, I don't think they
are. I mean, to be fair, if I lived by myself, I'd have a big screen. I'm not sure if I'd have a television.
Well, no, I have a television, but I don't use television. I just watch. Mm. I just use a computer and cast it or plug it in via HDMI.
So one of the questions that people get asked a lot, which I find baffling, is what's your favorite documentary? I wouldn't be able to name one that I've watched in the last 10 years, other than like the BBC Life David Attenborough one.
You see, indeed, I would say that. Although I've watched two this week. So on Indian railways, but that's because I'm going to India, I think.
You've watched two documentaries on Indian railways in the last week.
Yeah, I have. But I'm kind of getting into my documentaries and into, I'm looking at televisual media and how it, or thinking about how it's replacing the book in the modern world. So many people I meet do not read. And it's quite interesting. I mean, so they read what they have to read, and this is young people, and they do their work and things like that, but they don't read for pleasure. They don't pick things up out of their own choice and read them. And I think it's quite interesting, but they do watch an awful lot of videos. So I would argue that things like Lo and Behold, and Adam Curtis's work, Bitter Lake and Hypernormalization, these are important ones. I watched another really good thing the other day called Order and Disorder, The Story of Information, looking back to the greatest invention of all 5,000 years ago, which was...
The wheel? I don't know.
Oh, God, the written word. And it was the thing that allowed us to communicate information. So that's a fantastic documentary available on the iPlayer at the moment called Order and Disorder. Information, it's called. And by Jumali, is it? Someone, Jumali?
Oh, okay.
So I have been watching, looking at things like that I do find them genuinely very interesting, and sort of best TV I watch. I think there's, you know, I like the old documentaries these days.
You are 10 years older than me, so.
Yeah, no, it's true. Let me tell you this. There's this guy who works on the Indian Railway, and he'd been married. He'd worked on it for 32 years, and he'd been married for more than that. And he said the secrets to a happy marriage or to treating your wife correctly are 4 T's. Can you put you on the spot? Can you guess what they are?
4 T's?
4 words beginning with T.
No, what?
There you go, on the spot. So they are, they were... Talking, lots and lots of talking, he said, and time and trust and touch.
Oh, okay. And what was the last one?
Touch.
Touch.
Which he meant in a kind of affection way, not a sexual way, I don't think, particularly. although obviously that would
be... I think that's an important part, so I'll not get into the touching part of that because this is a family podcast. But the
hey kids,
the talking part of it, I imagine when you know my son starts, you know, randomly listening to Dad on his podcast. Although perhaps I'm just flattering myself, he'll never do that. But the talking part's interesting, isn't it? Because you know, I work from home, my wife works one day a week. We often talk a lot around the house, but then we send each other messages on Telegram all day, every day. Even like I'll be in my office, she'll be up there, little bits and pieces, sending each other animated GIFs, little emojis, that kind of thing. And it's all just part of the same thing, but it was that kind of back channel was not possible in previous generations.
No, absolutely. And it's about using the technology to the advantage of your relationship, your marriage, and your family indeed, and because that is the basis of your family. And I think these are great things. Mm. And people ignore this. You know, it's like Dana Boyd's point, isn't it? It's what are people just doing, communicating on their phones all of the time? Well, actually, they're not talking to random people who they're seeing in the street who they don't really know, or their friends at school or things like that. They're talking to the people who are nearest and dearest to them, you know, their best friends.
It goes full circle back to your getting, you know, how many people saying happy birthday to you. Like, they're micro points on a relationship that you're keeping going. And because of technology, we can keep... I remember reading an article about this. We can keep going many more relationships than we could have done previously because we just wouldn't have time to keep
up. And there's the true thing about it, sort of diminishing the face-to-face thing. But everyone keeps saying how... I had this conversation today with a cook, a caterer, and another cook. And
was there a candlestick maker in there as well?
No, there wasn't. It's generally their jobs. They work at the school. And so I was chatting to them and looking at devices and things like that. And someone made a snide remark because two of us were on our phones. And then before the conversation began, before all the people were assembled in the same spot. And I just thought, I'm sick and tired of people talking about technology in this way. I'm working on my phone. I'm talking to people. Do you know what I mean? I'm not just sitting here like checking the football scores or whatever, or whatever it is you think I'm doing that's worthless. That's not what's going on.
And I always feel self-conscious like when I'm... You know, we talked about the Twitch before, but today it wasn't the Twitch. I was in the doctor's waiting for some results, nothing serious. And I got my phone out because I needed to respond to loads of emails. And you can kind of see the older generation sitting there around you thinking, look at this guy who can't just sit there by, you know, without being entertained. And I'm thinking, like you said, like, screw you.
Yeah, no, just step back, you know. It's like, get out of my face. It's nothing to do with you. And because I feel, I mean, there are times when I use my technology and I think, actually, stop it. But mostly I use it productively and with a purpose. And that purpose I consider to be good on calm reflection, you know. And it's, I get bored. It's the same thing I said before, especially when there's people who do not use this technology talking about the impact this technology is having on young people, the stuff that Simon Sinek said about the millennials, like people, you know, the society is in dreadful hands because people aren't going to know how to...
Oh, I saw you said that he was one of your former students, yeah?
No. I didn't say that. But anyway, carry on.
All right. He does spout some crap.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? And he's a little pop star, you know.
What did he say this week? He said something about millennials, right, because they've been given participation trophies all their life, they have no work ethic or something.
Yeah, it's bullshit, isn't it? And so because the point is that lots and lots of people haven't been given participation trophies. And I sort of agree with the principle. It's like my daughter went to a state primary. Which was with dealing with people that were not like her.
Right.
So they didn't, you know, English was their second language. That was the main, you know, 28 languages spoken across a small school. And because she arrived in an odd year group, she was, you know, not at the beginning, as it were, she was assumed she was Polish because everyone there was foreign.
Oh, wow.
And she would get certificates for attendance. And the idea of having, she was on gifted and talented register, but there was no real there was no real sort of robustness to how you got on the gift in time to register. It was just for the good kids, really, you know, and that kind of thing. And I get what he's saying in that. But it's not true, you know, or certainly not my experience of schools. And I've taught in different kinds of schools.
No, and it also, you know, betrays a particular vision of what society is about, which is hyper-competitive. It's a scarcity model, isn't it? And yes. I don't think we live in a scarce world. I just think we live in a greedy world.
Yeah, and it falls into that trap of, you know, oh, the youth of today, aren't they? Oh,
yeah, exactly.
Well, it's going to ruin.
Anyway, while we talk about that kind of thing, the next link is about the slow professor movement. Now, this is actually a 30-minute segment on CBC, which is the Canadian equivalent of the BBC. I haven't listened to all of this, but the gist is that, you know, like the slow movement, it's the slow food movement.
Mm-hmm.
This is.
I listen to this as well.
You have listened to this, right? So I haven't listened all the way through. So perhaps you can introduce this.
Well, no, I haven't done all the way through either. I'm similar to you, but okay. But it was actually, I did really enjoy it. I think I got 2/3 of the way through or something like that, and had to go somewhere.
Okay.
But so they were essentially talking. I'm just going to have to remind myself now. Is that essentially it's about the dilution of quality within through the corporatization of universities. So professors are no longer allowed to like take time to things that they consider to be important. They have to get, much like schools, they have to get through a certain curriculum specification, whatever, within a certain amount of time. That time's always being squashed, and the resources that they get to allocate to it, or including time.
And they have to pump out articles and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and therefore, so people, you know, and it's one of those things of an aspirational and of the capitalist model, basically, of like we almost must be improving, is that you get these situations where someone's always going to come along to get to take a step up on the ladder, as it were. To say, well, I can do 3 articles a week and teach 4 classes.
It's like Frederick Taylor, isn't it? It's like the Taylorization of higher education.
Yes, it's exactly like that. So that Taylor's all about industrialization, isn't it? And and that sort of thing.
And the thing that surprised me was, you can imagine, so he's talking about 2 university professors, and I was expecting, you know, it to be two men, you know, privileged, entitled men saying, oh, well, we just need to slow down a bit and go back to the good old days. But no, it's Maggie Berg, a professor of English at Queen's University, and Barbara Sieber, who's a professor of English at Brock University, and they've co-authored this book. And there's a quote there on the page, isn't it? It says, really, we're being encouraged to stay away from the really big questions because they're going to take too long to think through. You want to pump out as much stuff as quickly as you can. There's going to have a consequence for how thoughtful things are. That's going to have a consequence for how thoughtful things are. And I remember a guy, was it W.V. Quine or someone like that? They literally published 1 paper in their entire academic career. Obviously contributed to many symposiums and taught wonderfully and wrote books and whatever. But the pressure was on. They had to write an article, and they wrote literally a 2-page article, which I think it was the 2 dogmas of empiricism, which just changed philosophy, you know. It was like, oh, well, if I must, you know, kind of thing.
I think this reminds me of, relating it to my life, I guess. So I remember with my children who achieved very well academically and are still doing so, when they didn't want to work, or when we had issues with any one of them not working, they would just choose, and I'm worried about this, I'm looking at revision at the moment, looking at using quizzes and how you use the kind of flashcard Kahoot sort of Quizlet quizzes kind of thing. And these different apps that do quizzes and in games and with competitions and also by themselves. And I'm sort of looking at, right, how good are these are at doing the thing of getting you ready for this examination that's a couple of months away. And let's talk about that. You know, let's talk about how effective is this. If you did this, how well do you think you'd be prepared for your exam? Do you think you'd be a top grade? Do you think you'd be middle grade? What do I? And so I'm looking at this, and with my own children, it was like I became very aware that more than being a teacher, that they had to do the hard yards of learning. The stuff that was just by themselves, where they would choose to do the thing is that they didn't get, and it was really tough. And I was, Yeah, I think this is a big thing, because what people tend to do is when they hit a problem and that they can't solve, they will default to like water, you know, it'll take a path of lesser resistance and default to an easier activity that they know that they can achieve, they know that they can do it. So they have that that gentle feeling of satisfaction and success, and which makes them allows them to feel good about themselves. And I think this is what Berg and Sieber are talking about here, is that if you don't take the time to take on the hard stuff, you never get to the good stuff. You know, you're always finding quality content, but not the best content that there is there to be studying to the related area. And that's huge, because over time you just get this dilution of quality and integrity to the subject, almost, and integrity to the thinking. I wonder what this plays to what Simon Sinek was saying about millennials. This plays to it, because...
No, it does, and yeah.
And I approve of facing the harder work in
We live in a measurement based society, so it's difficult to. We need alternative. The way to push back about this isn't by saying, "Oh, well, we should replace these tightly measured things with no forms of measurement at all." The way to it's a bit like the substitution stuff we were talking about before. The way to get rid of that is to come up with different measures. And we've talked before on this podcast about GDP versus the HDI, which is the Human Development Index, which Martha Nussbaum came up with. So find different ways of measuring stuff that you think is useful, even if it's a proxy, because everything's a proxy at the end of the day. Mm. I think this actually flows on nicely to a blog post on, it's on Medium, it's on a blog, it's on a publication called The Coffeelicious, which annoys me as a title. It's an awkward, pointless portmanteau, but it's an annoying title as well. The title is Why Learning is a New Procrastination. But the point is basically that head knowledge is pointless unless you're taking action. And the examples it gives are like you learn how to, you learn in your head by reading lots of things about how to do a Kickstarter campaign. Or you learn how to set up a business, but you don't actually go and set up that business or, you know, start that Kickstarter. You just, you know, have lots of head knowledge. So he's calling that procrastination. I would just call it not learning through doing, like just having head knowledge. And I think that's one of the reasons why I don't particularly like high stakes exams as the only way of testing, because it's pointless unless you're applying the knowledge, and application of knowledge isn't writing an essay under time conditions.
Yeah, stop learning by consuming, start learning by creating. Stop learning by researching, start learning by doing. Stop learning by listening, start learning by talking. Stop learning by reading, start learning by writing. Stop learning by watching the game, start learning by playing it. Stop postponing, start taking action.
Exactly. So I wouldn't call that procrastination, but it is... It's a theory of learning, isn't it?
I think there's a delicious thing about there you go, coffee-licious has made me say the word. about doing though. So I really love watching football, but there is a certain on the television. I really enjoy it, but there is a certain sense of moral degradation to it, the opium of the masses. You know, I sit right there in my armchair on my ass, watching 22 men kick a ball around, and I watch this, and watching once is like fine, but watching game after game after game, or three games a week, or whatever you watch, is just like pointless way to live your life. Because it doesn't matter, it's of no consequence. And you can argue that one game particularly might have a great set of circumstances and become a great game for whatever reason. But that repetitive action of doing that and doing it week upon week upon week throughout your life it's stupid. And it's certainly better to get up and go and play a game of football regularly and develop your own skills, or indeed go and watch the match and be a spectator.
Well, it's that locus of concern and locus of control thing, isn't it? Trying to expand that circle of control that you have in your life. So, you know, I can make a difference to the outcome of this football match because I'm playing it, or I'm coaching the team, or whatever, as opposed to I'm just watching it on TV and it has no relationship to me other than I happen to be watching it.
Yes, exactly. And it, it's an interesting thing. Anyway,
it's similar when you're learning something, because there's a difference between here is a body of knowledge to be learned and regurgitated, in which case you have no agency really, versus here's a body of knowledge which you should apply to your own life or how events are unfolding now. So this is the way that I prefer teaching history, and which is why I love the Hardcore History podcast so much, is what can history tell us about what's happening now in our society, and also what's happening to you, and philosophy with ethics and that kind of stuff. Like, it's not a dead subject because it's infinitely applicable, and, you know, history's rewritten, etc. So that kind of thing is much better. And it's a subtle difference sometimes when you're trying to talk to people in terms of schools and universities about what matters. Because, yeah, anyway, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I've had conversations with Amy Burble in the past about, she's a history teacher, days gone by, how she would teach things in themes. So she wouldn't teach a period of history or, you know, like the Tudors or something like that, but she would teach things in themes and look at how they changed over time and then into the present day to sort of compare and make it relevant and pertinent, which must be an approach that you're very familiar with as a history teacher.
No, definitely. And I remember teaching, I taught them... Medicine Through Time, which is one of my favorite things to teach. And there was also Crime and Punishment Through Time. And what you're doing is you're taking a slice across history and saying, how did different societies, what were their beliefs about medicine and disease and getting better, or how people should be treated and punished and that kind of thing. And what were their reasons for doing so? And I think it was Amy who recently in a Twitter conversation quoted Kierkegaard as saying, you know, life must be lived forwards and understood backwards, which is why I always find it bizarre that we teach kids from the earliest times through to the later times, as if just because history happened that way, that's the way we should teach it. Whereas I always think you should start from where they are and work backwards.
Indeed, it's an interesting thing, and pulling threads between the times as well. So I stopped learning history, so I didn't take it for O-level. So when I was 14, and I found it to be a dire subject, so there was some entertaining bits in it. And I remember learning, did I learn about the Second World War? I don't think I did, actually. I learned about plagues and fires and crap, I don't know. And some of it was sort of interesting, but not a lot of it. It didn't grip my imagination. And if they'd pulled threads from the present day back to whenever and looked at, how clothing had changed, how food had changed, how wars changed over time, and what caused them or whatever. Anything that would give you that analysis over time is interesting. When I went around San Francisco, what's interesting about it? It's the emergence of San Francisco from pre-1848 onwards, or is it 1748, whenever it was. And no, it's what they called 49. That's it. So, like, but when
after the fire as well with Chinatown,
It's absolutely all of that. It's the really interesting historical layer upon layer of how the city has emerged, and everybody at every stage is not in control and in charge. Generally speaking, they're dealing with. Dealing with a set of variables which are, and they're different variables at different times, but the variables are a tension, and that tension must be brought to a relaxed state, and that's what the city is, and that's what you see. It's interesting.
But that's the difference between great teaching and, teaching to the test, isn't it? So you can still get amazing results in terms of test scores with kids, as you do, for example, by scaffolding the attention and the interest of young people, old people, whoever, by giving them enough complexity to show that this isn't really a straightforward thing that you just need to learn, but there's layers and there's depth to this. That's one of the reasons I really like Mary Beard's book, the SPQR, because she's talking about the fact that, Romans writing in 200 BC about the founding of Rome and Romulus and Remus had no clue what was going on, even though it was only 400 years previously that it was supposed to have been set up. Literally, they had no history to go off. They were just making stuff up. And just seeing how they talked about themselves and how they developed this empire. And, one of my favorite things was when the school's history... Sorry, I'm reminiscing and going off on one now. But the school's history project brought out a book on Oliver Cromwell for year 8 when I was just starting teaching.
Uh-huh.
And it was fascinating to teach because this textbook, and I wasn't a big fan of textbooks. I used to use one page of one and a couple of pages from another. But this textbook, I went through every page of it with the kids because it was talking about interpretations of Cromwell over time and how that said more about the society itself that was doing the reinterpretation than it did about Oliver Cromwell. And you could just see kids' eyes open to the world and like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really fascinating. I bet if you go back to the article we were on before, the two professors talking about not facing the tougher questions, you know, the harder, more challenging stuff, and avoiding that so that, because it takes longer to do it, I bet that's the sort of thing that they're talking about. You know, if you unravel that and talk to them, I bet it is the same thing.
Okay, let's move on. We've talked about Amy. I used her post, the graphics from her post, and some of the stuff that she was talking about. This is a post entitled 5 W's Trajectory of EdTech Love. And usually the 5 W's, which are often used in journalism and in primary schools and stuff, are who, what, when, why, and where. Whereas she has changed them differently. She's still got the why in there, but she's got workflow, wonder, wow, and world. And just some really nice things in there, along with some lovely pink and black graphics, as is her style. And so, yeah, what do you think of this one? She mentions this in it, so it must be good.
Yeah. You and I get mentioned, and Tide gets mentioned, so there's lots of EdTech love going on there. So I thought this was lovely. So it's a really interesting idea because essentially Amy is looking at making things more human, more interesting, and for people to do. So, you know, looking at the why people are doing things, she says start with the why and things, and then things will fly. She does seem to love a rhyme and alliteration. So, looking at her workflow, it says that a purely utilitarian approach can capture even the most critical naysayer. How will this technology improve my workflow and productivity? I think this is one of the things Amy does really, really well. She's good at bringing people on board to what she's saying and it being really practical and seeing how they might use it. Will your workflow make things easier, more efficient, faster? Can it augment the ways in which we work, such as Google Docs or cloud-based collaboration, real-time collaboration, and that sort of thing? So it's just the interpretation that she puts on a lot of the processes that...
Yeah, it's a different way of viewing the world, isn't it? And, you know, we've just been talking about the very top-down, like, outcome-focused, here's the exam kind of view of the world. And this is obviously a very different view of the world, which is difficult to measure. We've got a client, the co-op's got a client in Ireland. It's the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. And I don't think I'm saying anything out of turn by saying that there's some issues in Ireland at the moment with some of the reforms that the government and the Department of Education want to push through, which the unions or some unions are pushing back on, for example.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting how it's difficult to make it when you're doing things on a two-dimensional level and saying, well, this is the for reason, this is the against, you don't get anywhere unless you change the... If you change the battlefield or the way that the problem is viewed, then you can come to some kind of solution. And I think this is what Amy's talking about here. So often when I go and do work, you know, the presentation I did on Monday and the presentation I did last night with a school and a university, similar situations, everyone's working at almost their full capacity. So this thing that you're asking me to do seems like something which will never happen because, oh my goodness, who's got time? And even if it was a good idea, these are all the things I'm doing. Whereas this is a way of reframing that by saying some things are about working more efficiently and faster, but sometimes it's about rekindling your sense of wonder as an educator or producing a sense of wow in your peers and your students. And so I really like that reframing and encouragement to connect to the world, because I think that it just gets around some of the, well, you say this and I say the opposite, therefore we're interlocked in locking horns now and forever. So I like that.
Yeah, I agree. When you try and turn, if you try to turn this post into an algorithm kind of thing for how to integrate ed tech into schools or learning or whatever, then you'd fail miserably. It's just because it's about that sort of sense of inquiry and being surprised by things, you know, and with them coming from unexpected places, and about being dogged in sharing your stuff because somebody, probably not the person you expected to, is going to turn around and bite and say, yeah, I see that, I like that, I do this, and that kind of thing.
One of the, I use this analogy a lot, I'm probably using this podcast as well, but someone once told me that when you're evangelizing, you need to do it like 6 or 7 times before people are likely to really understand what you mean. And I think it's similar when you're evangelizing anything. So open badges, technology and education, whatever. And to use another kind of biblical thing, there's people who are ready to hear what you're saying, and there's people who aren't ready. And you can't control who's in the audience. You can't control, you know, who's just had a bad day. You can't control people who aren't listening because they're thinking about something they're really worried about. You can't control, you know, someone's never heard of this thing before, so it's going straight over their head. So you just kind of have to try and, as Brian Mathers says, make things have cognitive ease, and just hope for the best, really, quite often.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have confidence in what you're doing.
Mm.
And let it fly.
Yeah, I think people feed off confidence and seeing a strong belief in something, in someone else. You know, William James used to say that our belief in things is a belief in other people's belief.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a true thing, isn't it? It's like, so because when you think about things, you kind of have people in your thoughts as you do them, like the mirrors we talked about before, the sort of 5 chimps or whatever, that kind of thing. And psychological mirrors that you have inside yourself as you think. And if you have someone that you know is holding a touchstone for a particular thing, it kind of makes it easier, you know. That's Anyway. Okay, Aral Balkan.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, let's just draw that section to a close, because I think the other links in here, I mean, those ones fitted together reasonably well. We put the title EdTech Learning in Real Life, kind of goes with that, I guess. But the rest of the links we've got, just keeping an eye on time, there's quite a lot in there. We'll not get through them all. Do any of them kind of grab your attention, or have you read any of these?
Yes. So the bottom one, wearable fitness devices don't seem to make you fitter. So I'm interested in this at the moment. Just because I'm curious, I don't have one, but I'm considering buying one for my father, who's 77 and has had...
Oh, I just assumed that you would have one, Di.
No, I don't have one at all. So I don't have to. I don't use a car. I don't use a bike. I walk everywhere. So, and I stand up most of the day. So I have a standing desk at home, and I haven't shared this. I bought a standing desk adapter at work for 130 quid, I think.
So what type is it?
Oh, I can't remember. Okay. But it's white, and it has 2 handles on the side, and it has a keyboard and mouse shelf, and then just another shelf on top. And it stands about, I'd say, just less than 2 foot maybe off the desk. So I've just put it on my desk at work and taken a anti-fatigue mat in. And so I don't have a chair now unless I put it down. And that keeps me on my feet and keeps me moving to the pupil's desk rather than getting comfy in my chair, which is the reason I like it more than anything. But it also allows me to be in control of when I stand and when I sit. So I have a standing desk at home, which I work in from when I wake up to when I go into classrooms. And whenever I come back during the day. But it's nice to have that in my classroom. And it also, you know, I did the standing desk thing down the side of my classroom.
Yeah.
Well, it's never been really very successful. Like, pupils don't use it as that. And I thought, there's a reason for that. And it's because I'm not doing it.
Right.
So I thought, I need to put my, you know, to walk the talk. And so I got it in my classroom so they can see me doing that. And they are really, really interested in it.
Mm. Well, I'm standing at my standing desk right now.
I've been standing all day, and then before supper, I played squash with someone half my age and beat them. So I'm.
It's because of the standing desk.
It must be. I'm sitting down.
Mm. Well, this particular article. So I've mentioned before that, and again, it's always the context, isn't it? So, for example, I don't use a Fitbit anymore because I don't particularly want them having my data and selling it to insurance companies, even if they say they're not doing it. I don't care. My wife. uses a Fitbit all the time. She still swears by the 10,000 steps, even though the 10,000 steps things came from one study in 1960 in Japan. And it just seems to be like a nice round number. I think she's actually upped hers to 12,000. But the thing which really motivates her, as I've talked about before, is competitions with her friends. So yeah. Work week hustle, you know, trying to get more steps this weekend, whatever. Yeah. But I find this particular post, this is in the Upshot, which is part of the New York Times. Like, Aaron Carroll, the author, needs to just go do some kind of logic course on, like, understanding how to construct an argument.
Yeah.
So the title is, Wearable Fitness Devices Don't Seem to Make You Fitter. Then he says, during the article, that for some time people have been trying to prove devices like these succeed in promoting weight loss. Then he talks about the fact that exercise doesn't make you lose weight, it makes you fitter. And then at the end, he says, people didn't lose weight, therefore people aren't getting fitter. And you're like, we've just said that weight loss and fitness are two separate things. How does that work?
I clocked that, and that's a very good point. I think this is all, I mean, I really hate this sort of thing against poo-pooing something that's come in through the technological market or any other market, actually. People like doing something, and it makes them walk more. And so my take on this is, if you look at whatever they call the blue zones or something, the sort of areas of population in the world where people live above 100 as standard, live the longest in the world, like areas in Japan and other such things. And you look at what these areas have in common, and it is that they don't use cars, they walk as part of their daily routine all of the time, and they eat a plant-based diet. You know?
And do they drink lots of alcohol and watch TV?
They do that. They all smoke red wine, a bottle a night, I think.
Excellent. Sounds good. Whiskey. Excellent. I had a... So the reason I went to the doctor, I'm not particularly... Unless it's insanely embarrassing, I don't care about talking about any of this stuff. My dad's having a pacemaker fitted next week. So me being the hypochondriac that I am, knowing that my dad's dad died of having a weak heart. Okay, he smoked all his life, but he had a weak heart as well. And my dad's, I thought... Well, actually, maybe it's not just me getting older. The reason I'm not doing exercise to such a intense level, maybe it's something wrong with my heart. So I went along and I still need to get the results back, but I had an ECG and I had my blood pressure taken, and my blood pressure is like 110 over 70, which is fine. I don't particularly, my smart band, I don't wear because it tracks my steps, even though it can and does. I wear it because I get the vibrating notifications, and if it didn't have the steps on, I wouldn't care. But, there was a time in the past when I had a Fitbit when, I would try and get as many steps as I possibly could. Whereas now I realize that actually steps aren't the important thing, I wouldn't say.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. So, but I don't think... See, I don't think if people are like stepping more because they wear a Fitbit and they're thinking more about their activity during a day, it's just not a bad thing. I think shut up. That's all. Do you know what I mean? I just think.
But did you see the results in this article? So this guy, who is actually professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, needs to do a course in logic, like I said. But he talks about two groups, and it says that one of them had... Basically, one was the Fitbit group and one was the control group who didn't have Fitbits. And the ones who didn't have Fitbits lost more weight.
Yeah. And then that doesn't surprise me, does it? You? Doesn't surprise me at all. And the reason it doesn't surprise me is if they were aware that the other people had Fitbits and they didn't, then I would make sure I lost weight as part of that study.
No. But this is a double blind trial. This is so what I would say that the cause of that was, without knowing about other people's psychological states, is that, oh, well, I've reached my step target for today, so now I can reward myself.
Yes, indeed. Or yes, if that's what they're thinking. Or people have let's be fair, people have quite a secretive strain to life at times, and they will do exactly that. It's like they will walk 10,000 steps and then they will eat 5 donuts per step. And You know, and because they feel like they've earned it. And when we've all seen that kind of thing before, I've seen it in people who are trying to lose weight, whom I'm friends with and very fond of. But people do that sort of thing, isn't it? It's like, what would you call it? I want to use words like bias confirmation, but it's not.
Well,
that.
Everyone can have special pleading about their own life. And, you know, I'm sure even Hitler didn't think he was a bad person.
Yes, there you go.
But yeah, it is confirmation bias, and it's also like just being able to justify anything to yourself. So yeah, anyway, there's lots of other articles in here. What else kind of struck you, got caught your attention?
Let's go have a look. Why Nothing Works Anymore.
Did you read this one?
I think I did.
This was in The Atlantic. So this is Ian Bogost, who is a wonderful writer. And what he's talking about is that, and he is very good at writing this. He's talking, I mean, the picture at the top is about bathrooms. My son loves it. I think he's only come across one, and I think it was in an airport in his life, where everything was automatic. So the door going in is automatic. You go to the toilet in the urinal or you know, for number two, and that's automatic. The flush is automatic. And then you put your hands there, and the soap is automatic, the water is automatic, the dryer is automatic. So basically, you don't have to press any buttons. Like that's his thing.
Yeah, you don't touch anything. It's kind of.
But he. Yeah, so Ian Bogost in this post talks about how that kind of trains us into a way of thinking, and how, you know, he gives the example of toilets flushing three times instead of one, faucets open at full blast, towel dispensers mete out paper so miserly that people take more than they need. Instead of saving resources, these apparatuses mostly save labour and management costs. So he's talking about technology as being a very neoliberal, let's get rid of expensive things like people. And we're getting used to that kind of stuff. And obviously my children are growing up in that kind of environment. And he does go off on one, talking about 1930s and how life used to be and all that kind of stuff. But I do like this article. I like the way he writes, just in terms of the stuff that we get used to and we're being kind of slowly boiled like the frog in the saucepan.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is frog in the saucepan stuff, isn't it? And it actually rocks back to what we were discussing earlier about the dilution of standards over time that are invisible, effectively, to the naked eye. And there has to be some appreciation of what that is going to have. But I don't think, you know, is he right? Do you think? Is he right? Is this automation? I mean, the automation is caused, obviously, is instilled by corporate motivations, as in making more profit.
I think the easiest paragraph to quote is the last one. So do you want to do that, or shall I?
I'll do it.
Okay.
The effects of business consolidation and just-in-time logistics offer...
Whoa, not that one.
Oh, sorry, I'm not at the bottom.
It goes further.
Okay, here we go. There is a dream of computer technology's end, in which machines become powerful enough that human consciousness can be uploaded into them, facilitating immortality. And there is a chorus, I'm just going to interject there, the lovely thing about robots, I think, who said this? Was it Donald Clark, I think? just informally, he said that robots, you know, if you teach a robot, a little robot's going to learn stuff really, really quickly because it can get the data off other things, whereas a human being takes ages to teach and it's not going to die. So robots are obviously a much better choice than people. Anyway, so facilitating immortality. And there is a corresponding nightmare in which the evil robot of a forthcoming computerized mesh overpowers and destroys human civilization.
So that's Skynet.
Absolutely. But there is also a weirder, more ordinary, and more likely future, and it is the one most similar to the present. In that future, technologies and humanity's goals split from one another, even as the latter seems ever more yoked to the former. Like people ignorant of the plight of ants, and like ants incapable of understanding the goals of the humans who loom over them, so technology is becoming a force that surrounds humans, that intersects with humans, and that makes use of humans, but not necessarily in the service of human ends. It won't take a computational singularity for humans to cede their lives to the world of machines. they've already been doing so for years without even noticing.
So it's quite a jump from talking about how everything's automatic in toilets to getting to that. But, you know, when I've been doing research on blockchain and distributed autonomous organizations and how pure automation and blockchain and everything like that could actually make the 1% or the 0.1% rich beyond their wildest dreams to the detriment of all of us and hoard money in an automated way, I think it's entirely right. I think it is pretty dystopian, but I don't think he's particularly wrong in the way things are heading.
I had a really interesting conversation on Saturday with a Russian parent of one of our pupils whom I teach, and he doesn't speak particularly good English. So one of the things that he said, he's a Russian entrepreneur rather than an oligarch, one of the things that he said was that his nephew is working for KPMG, one of the largest consultancy companies in the world. And he said that 50% of the people working at KPMG now are programming, and which is huge. So if you think about how, you know, things are changing, when you talk about education, you talk about digital education, you talk about computer science education, you talk about programming and everyone learning how to code. It's a really interesting thing because so many jobs now that earn a big wage. And interestingly, when my pupils were in San Francisco and talking to all the big tech corps, one of them said that the starting wage for a programmer was in excess of $200,000 a year, a graduate programmer.
Wow.
Massive, isn't it? But living in San Francisco, though, is crazily expensive. But it just shows how things are changing and like what he's saying, it's like it is going on already and we're just really not noticing it. And these, you know, like my school doesn't offer compulsory technology education like IT or digital literacy or computer science for anyone in the main part of the school.
Do you not think though that, and I think there was an article on this that we talked about recently, do you not feel like about blue collar programmers? There's always, in any field, there's going to be people who are paid lots of money and people who are paid not as much.
Yeah.
But as soon as we get to the stage where the IDE, the method of programming, you've already got that kind of thing in Scratch where it's pretty easy to drag and drop stuff. Yeah. As soon as that's possible through being able to talk to a computer, which then builds a program or codes something which does the thing that you want, it's modular, the less we're going to need, not as many coders, but less we're going to need people doing the creative kind of coding that's happening now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. So take this as an idea, possibly, is that this is going to be the glory age where we have people who are actually learning how to program using a higher level language. So they're not using machine code. They're not working at a low level. They're working at a higher level. So they're working at the discipline of somebody else's code. So, you know, like Python, for example, was written by somebody and the limitations and possibilities within it are set by somebody else. But still in that, you're still able to control lots of things within pretty much all the things that a computer can do kind of thing. Whereas in the future, what we'll be doing is people will, like you say, they'll be like emailing their computer to program it. They won't be, do you know what I mean? But that will only work, say, like Swift that Apple have made, the programming language for working on iOS. They will make that, but they will control the things that you can do with your programming. It will become a limited sort of environment in which you can work and at the behest of other people.
You mean a bit like using Windows or Mac?
Exactly. It sort of limits what you're doing. It sort of pulls it into a smaller umbrella, if you like.
So you feel like you can do almost anything But of course, you're not aware of the things which are outside of the situation in which you're in.
And you'll come back to this time when people were able to program computers to do whatever they wanted. It's like a glory age of rebellion, you know, where people actually had the tools at their fingertips to control automation and to write algorithms. That's one of the things I was looking at today. I watched a program on Computing at Schools TV channel that Miles Berry is doing, and there's some great stuff on there for... but this was the best one I've seen. It was on interviewing a guy called Paolo Casanova, who works for Google.
Casanova, eh?
Indeed, he works for Google down in London. They were talking about graph theory, which is sort of mapping nodes and edges principle used in for decomposition in computational thinking. And so you're having this sort of really interesting discussion. But what I thought about whilst they were talking was I was trying to unravel, okay, I'm trying to think here, how do people working for Google or whatever, you writing Google Maps, for example, how do they have, where are the algorithm limitations set? So that algorithm isn't built to be evil, but it could be that it has some negative effects and they don't realize it. So how are they checking that? Where's the quality assurance in keeping their algorithms clean and going back to
the this is why I think that at the moment, sorry,
it's just keeping it so not necessarily, I'll quote again the paragraph I just read, not necessarily in the service of human ends, making sure that algorithm stays within the service of human ends. It's an important thing, you know.
No, definitely. I think at the moment we've got coders, programmers who are expected to be some kind of alchemist. So they're supposed to be able to do all of the things you mentioned, like the ethics behind stuff and the understanding the limitations of the code base and the writing of clean, efficient code which can be easily updated by someone other than themselves and all this kind of stuff. And I feel like some of that needs to be abstracted away or automated. But of course, as soon as you do that, then you're constraining what people can do. And I think that's the reason why humanities is extremely important when we're talking about the world of tech, because the clue's in the name. It's about humans and humanity and how we can interact with each other, but also with the technology which we invent. So, yeah, I would say this because that's my background, but I think that humanities is especially important when we're moving into these crazy new worlds.
Yeah, I saw a really interesting article by, can't remember, it was a Medium article talking about a lady whose name I can't remember who was working at MIT, and then she had a robot, and she knew exactly, it was a dinosaur, and the dinosaur, if you held it by the tail upside down, it cried, and she knew exactly why it cried and what made it do that, but she was compelled to stop it crying. She was really interested in that, so she went away and did a degree in psychology and went back to MIT to work, and it's looking at that at the work that is being done protecting these human ends, you know, making sure that technology and policy is written to look after these things. Interesting.
So look after the dinosaurs which are being held upside down?
Them and the humans. So the extinct toys and the human people too. And the segue in between, where they meet. This is the rub.
Oh, because otherwise we could just become so... Yeah,
because our behavior can be manipulated so easily by a machine. That's the thing. That's the point she was looking at. So she would take this robot, and she knew why it was doing it. She knew every nut and bolt in the robot. She understood the robot completely, and yet still she felt compelled to act towards this effectively soulless, inanimate object. And that's what sparked her interest. So it's like, so if machines can do certain things, and we're going to go to another article in this list in a second, which is relevant, that if machines can make humans act in certain ways and humans can't help themselves because we're human, then we've got to be really careful.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's a bit of a film. Have you seen the film Elysium?
I have. Yes.
So there's that bit where Matt Damon comes back down and he has to interact with a machine, which has obviously been punched a few times. And it says, you're feeling stressed. I sense that you're feeling stressed. Would you like me to activate whatever mode and calm you down? And he's like, oh my goodness, because it's just pushing his buttons and he has to respond to the technology rather than the technology responding to him. But like you say, as soon as the technology allows the psychological profiling to be able to manipulate your emotions, then yeah, we're in crazy town.
Yes, so that's absolutely right. I think it's perfect. So the article I want to talk about next is the Alexa Siri Cortana article. The problem with all female digital assistants, which is a Wall Street Journal article. Mm-hmm. This is a really sort of gentle ask for people to switch on the male voices on these automated systems. Because it's not good. Oh, I can't read the full story. I could the other day. Why not? Oh, no, it's a podcast. I listened to it. That was it. It's an audio which I listened to by a lady called Joanna Stern, I think. Mm-hmm.
So the point that she's making is that if we continually listen to something which is in our service with a female voice, then we come to think that that's what female voices are for.
Yes, exactly, and they play those sort of gender stereotypical roles, and they're bollocks. So switch. You can't. Who is it? Is it Siri? You can change to a male voice. You can't.
Yeah, and apparently you've been able to do that for years. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, you have since the beginning, as far as I'm aware. Mm. But that's the only one. The other two you can't change. They're famous female voices, and they stay that way.
Yep.
Interesting. And Google Home is the same. It's not got a male option.
There is one, though, that I think is by default female in one country and male in a different country.
Is that right?
Mm, I can't remember which one it is. I think it might have been Siri to start off with.
I'd like to drink a pint and guess which countries they were. Guess which ones the female ones are. That's easy.
But yeah, I mean, I don't tend to use this kind of stuff, but if you're using a digital assistant and, I don't know, you've got someone called Alexa,
She's listening. There she goes.
I'm not sure what went wrong.
Yeah. Can you change her voice?
No, I can't. So she is
hard-coded.
And that's interesting. I can change her name. So she doesn't have to be called Alexa. So she can be called Amazon and Echo, I believe.
Or computer as well, I think.
Yeah, no, computer. They've added that one today. But quite interestingly, there's somebody who...
Well, just on that quickly, while I remember... I was sitting in Rome airport ready to get up. Now, I haven't got any status with, well, anyone anymore, but any status with KLM. So when I got ready to board, I wasn't in the sky priority lane and all that bollocks.
Yeah.
But it was interesting just watching the air stewardess in action as to who she let into the sky priority lane without questioning should they be there, as opposed to people who she questioned, and every single time she got it right, as to whether they should be in that lane or whether actually they had an economy ticket. And of course she was racially profiling, and of course she was looking at how smartly people were dressed. And the kind of liberal in me was shocked by the way that she was treating people, but at the same time realized that she was just doing her job and she was doing it very well.
Yes, that's it. So she was automating. And
but of course, if you continually do that day after day after day after day, you start putting people in the box of, oh, look, well, black people don't seem to be very rich, therefore they do, or, you know, and it's a slippery slope from kind of, are this way to should be that way. You know, that's what slave owners, like last week we were talking about being historically disappointed in people.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So, yeah, if you're listening to this and you use digital assistants often, see if you can switch it to a different kind of voice, because it's good for you long term.
It is, indeed. I would suggest it is good for your psychological balance. Excellent, excellent. I watched an interesting, there's a really good BBC iPlayer again. Roots remake is on at the moment. And I thoroughly recommending 4 1.5-hour episodes. So it's quite a big commitment.
Is it just called Roots or?
Just called Roots. And it was made when I was, I think it was made just before I would watch anything of that sort. So I must have been about, I don't know, 12 or something. So it must have been in the 80s. It's been remade. I'm not sure by whom. But it's really very good. Some great acting, great casting, but it's also a fantastic story about slavery. So I thoroughly recommend watching that.
Cool. Our thing I'm going to put in here is, well, I probably should have mentioned it earlier. This is in New Scientist, and it's artificial intelligence learns to write its own code by stealing from other programs. So there's a massively loaded word in here, isn't it, which is stealing. Now, what if it actually, the stuff that it's appropriating is openly licensed, for example? This could be just the best thing ever. It could be Skynet, but it could also be the best thing. This is Matt Reynolds in New Scientist saying that it could allow non-coders to simply describe an idea for a program and let the system build it, but it's using the language of stealing from other people and talking about, you know, code as intellectual property and stuff, which, you know, it is sometimes, but the whole notion of intellectual property is entirely flawed. So it's a nice extension to what we were talking about earlier.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. So it's all about A, language, and B, it's really interesting that AI can now, because this is the whole point of AI, is it's not going to steal code from other programs. Those programs are all going to learn how to work together. Computers are all going to learn how to talk to each other and to learn from each other and take what's relevant and ignore what's not.
Yeah.
And that's really the point of this article, is that computers are going to be much better at working in unity than human beings are.
Yes.
And collaborate, etc.
Cool. Anything else on that list you want to talk about? Or
I did read that loneliness actually hurts us on a cellular level.
What do you think about that?
I'm a big believer in this sort of thing. I'm a big believer that in this is the reason why we try and live our lives well, and we try and improve and reflect and fail and such like. And it's another article related, actually, article is why we need loneliness, actually, which I haven't read. But there's a really interesting graphic on here, a GIF graphic that goes through the percent of the US population by age group from 1950 to 2060, looking how they're aging, basically, and it sort of bulges as time goes on. So there's lots more old people as time passes on because we're all living longer and that sort of thing. But it talks about loneliness and the sort of chemical response in our bodies. Mm. Inflammation is something.
Well, let's go through the how many reasons is it there? There's a couple of reasons which it says why.
Yeah, let's do that.
So that the first one is gene. So it says, how does a feeling like loneliness influence our biology? Mm-hmm. And this is, it references different studies, and it says, number one, genes that code for the body's inflammation response are turned on to a degree not seen in non-lonely participate. Not, come on, Paul Shaw. Genes that code for the body's inflammation response are turned on to a degree not seen in non-lonely participants.
Yes, so inflammation around acute injuries and things like that serves as fertilizer for chronic diseases, which I would argue is true.
Yep.
It feels true to me. We know it's... I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it? Because you hear stories about, you know, fit people who run marathons falling down from heart attacks playing squash or something.
I think it would be uncontroversial for most people if you said loneliness leads to mental issues in terms of like depression and things.
Mm-hmm.
But this is saying it's a physical thing.
Yes, exactly. So the interesting thing to me here is that all of these things are connected. So that what you get is that, you know, your diet, your activity, your mind, your body, they're all connected. There are things going through them. I would argue this about being barefoot. You know, I feel better when I walk barefoot. Do I have the ability or the power to decipher why? I'm not really sure. I could give you lots and lots of different explanations of why, which are completely sort of psychosomatic, psychological things that are nothing to do with the real world. Or I could give you actual physical explanations of which I've never investigated, but through reflexology, for example. So people believing that all parts of the body are connected to a part of your foot or a point in your foot. So the fact that I exercise my feet in ways that other people just do not means that I have access to feelings or I'm looking after my system. It's like having a massage every time I walk on an uneven surface. You know, there are things like that. So I do believe that the body and the mind are connected, interestingly. Getting enough sleep and things like that. I was just thinking today, because I was up late last night, because it was my birthday and whatever. I wasn't too drunk. It was all good. But I was very conscious of feeling tired today through everything that I did and how it affected my mood and how that has that kind of domino effect of everyone as a teacher. I meet a lot of people every day, and the energy that I bring to those people is important. And you know, it wasn't at its best because I didn't get enough sleep, that kind of thing.
Anyway, well, just on this loneliness thing, yeah, absolutely what you said. It's difficult kind of trying to maintain your kind of healthy balance too. I saw this on Twitter. I've just been trying to find it. So this was a guy called Douglas Lucas. So it must be good because he shares my name. And someone retweeted this into my stream. And it was talking about how the way that science works kind of... You mentioned about kind of being... thinking that something's psychosomatic or relying on evidence which isn't necessarily classed as scientific. And I've been writing about evidence recently, and I need to kind of temper, like I said last week, I need to temper what I say with making sure that people don't draw the wrong conclusions from what I'm saying. But there's a really interesting thing here taken from someone's book. And I'll not read the whole thing, but basically it's saying, like, someone goes into a remote village and does a study 1 year, and then a few years later notices that the whole tribe seems to have shrunk on average, and tries to infer something about the food source or whatever. But of course they don't ask the question about who the father of the children are. And, you know, one guy who was 5'4" has had 27 children. And that's the reason why they've all shrunk on average. Yeah. And just trying to kind of balance the really hard-nosed empirical data with the story around it, which might do some explaining. And I feel like there's some of that in everything that we do, in whether it's educational technology, whether it's you know, hardcore science and anthropology or whatever. And so this loneliness article, I feel like there's some things that we know, which are stories, which are kind of folk knowledge as opposed to scientific knowledge, but it doesn't mean that it's any less, it doesn't mean it's wrong, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I like this particular paragraph where, so it's talking about this guy, Cole, who's the lead author on a particular research paper, and it says, overall, Cole finds the response to chronic loneliness isn't different than the response to other sources of chronic stress, like low socioeconomic status or living with post-traumatic stress. You see the same general molecular pattern across a diverse range of bad human life circumstances, he says. Loneliness activates the body's generic stress response.
Yes, and I think that's fair enough. Really, I think that's right. I think that's what it does, and I think these things are all connected, and I think it's... I'm old, you know, but it's kind of... As I get older, I do more things, I think, that's... allow me to appreciate the world around me, and that counteract my negative feelings about whatever it might be at any one point. And I have to do that more and more consciously, whereas when I was younger, I just wouldn't. I just, like, dive further into it.
Mm. Yeah, knowing where the boundaries are and stuff, absolutely. Okay, anything else took your fancy, or shall we leave it there?
I think we should leave it there. You were up very late last night, so you need to get to bed.
This is true. Okay, I will I'll mark those as... I'll keep them in there, just in case you want to refer to them on another podcast episode. But this has been Tide episode 77, a bit of a ramble chat, EdTech, learning, and real life with Di and I. Di, what are you up to this coming week?
I'm going to the dogs on Saturday with the upper six from my boarding house. My parents are coming for supper tomorrow night. That'll be really nice. Mm-hmm. And as a sort of birthday celebration. So I'm looking forward to seeing them. Other than that, I don't know what I'm doing next week. I haven't looked at it yet. What are you up to?
So we're recording this on the evening of Thursday, the 2nd of March. What am I doing? I presented to Australia last night. I've had a few meetings today. Tomorrow is a dog day. Tomorrow is a day when I'm trying to do no work. I traveled last Sunday. I feel like I've already finished my week now. So tomorrow I'll be cleaning the fish tank and reading some books and doing that kind of thing. Next week, my son is away on a residential from Monday to Friday. I'm doing a book sprint at, Story Hack, as I think it's called, at Gateshead Library. So I'm a paid facilitator, but I'm in the privileged position of learning from some awesome people. So I'm looking forward to that.
Remember to set your stuff toy.
Oh, yeah, I need to make sure I take that so that people actually do some learning. But no, this is trying to create a book or some documentation in a short period of time. Okay. I've got some more meetings and a bit more work to do. And then I'm traveling to Dublin next Thursday and doing some work with Brian with the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. So doing a think-a-thon on Friday and then going for a few Guinnesses and then flying home. That's what I'm doing.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Excellent.
Good.
Well, have a good week if you're listening, or indeed if you're Doug.
All right, cheers, Di. Cheers, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye. At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.